You're listening to the podcast of Village Church in Burbank, California. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org. We hope you enjoy today's message.
Well, we're continuing on in our series, The Seven Sayings from the Cross. And let's look at our text. We're going to jump right into it. John chapter 19, verses 28 through 29. Jesus hears on the cross, and it says, after this, when Jesus knew that all was now finished, he said, in order to fulfill the scripture, I am thirsty. A jar full of sour wine was standing there. So they put a sponge full of the wine on a branch of hyssop and held it to his mouth. This is the fifth cry from the cross. Next week, Palm Sunday, we'll look at the sixth cry, and then that Friday, we're going to finish this series with the seventh and final cry from the cross. But this is the fifth one, and it's the shortest one, when Jesus says, I thirst. I'm pretty sure all of you have heard this throughout your lives, that as human beings, our bodies are composed of mainly water. Now, it's not like 98% water. I've heard that before. That's way overshooting it. I don't even know how that's physically possible. But we are about 75% water, about three-fourths. So water, just physically speaking, water is the most basic need of human beings. And to be human is to be regularly thirsty. And I suppose that may be why the Bible frequently uses thirst as a metaphor to represent the entire spectrum of human need. When God, the second person of the Trinity, became a human being, when the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, he enters into our world of human need. Don't ever think of Jesus as kind of a divine Superman flying around being God all over the place, but totally impervious to human need. No, he experienced the full gamut of human neediness. Jesus knew hunger and thirst. He knew cold and heat. He knew all of the aches and pains that come with being a human being. And it finds its culminating point here on the cross when Jesus cries out, I thirst. And some men gather at the base of the cross who had been mocking him. They take a branch of hyssop and put a sponge on the end of it and dip it in a bowl, and they offer to him sour wine, which is to say vinegar. You know, if you've ever worked out in your garden or out in your lawn for a couple hours in the middle of the July heat, when you come back inside your house, I'm sure you're not hoping to find a glass of warm vinegar on the counter. But that is what Jesus is offered on the cross. And John connects this to a psalm that was written hundreds of years earlier in Psalm 69, verse 21, where we read, for my thirst, they gave me sour wine to drink. And so on the cross, his thirst is answered with cruelty and not with kindness. Now John, who's writing this, as I frequently point out, John is an artistic theologian. And by the time that John is writing his account of Jesus' life, the other three gospel authors, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, their accounts of Jesus' life have already been circulating for at least 20 years. They've already been floating around, and people are very familiar with them, including John. John's aware that Matthew, Mark, and Luke already have accounts of Jesus' life that are out there. And so when John sits down to write what we call the Gospel of John, he's thinking, I'm doing something different here. I don't need to replicate what those three men did. I'm going to do something different. And John writes with a theological agenda. And he wants to teach using artistic memoir. And when John records this moment, when Jesus cries out from the cross, I'm thirsty, and they give him sour wine, John is hoping that you'll remember two stories that he's already told you and make the connection. Both stories have to do with water. Both stories have to do with human need, and most importantly, both of them have to do with kindness. Let's take a moment and remember these stories. First of all, there's the story of the woman at the well in John 4. When Jesus and his disciples, they've been traveling all day long. They've been traveling a long ways, and they're in the region of Samaria. And at the end of a long day, they come to the outskirts of a town called Sychar. And Jesus' disciples go into the village to buy some food. Jesus stays behind, and he's exhausted. He's worn out. He's dog-tired. He's hungry, and he's thirsty. Again, don't think of Jesus as some divine superhuman. Just as if you had been walking for 10 miles, like some of you are going to do tomorrow, you'd be tired and thirsty and worn out. Well, Jesus was too. And Jesus finds a place to sit by this well, this water well outside the village. And yet there's no container there for him to use to draw water out of it. And then eventually this Samaritan woman comes and approaches the well, and she's got a bucket of water. And Jesus says, "Give me something to drink." And this Samaritan woman is stunned. Because first of all, Jews and Samaritans just didn't mix. They absolutely hated one another. In fact, the enmity was so strong between Jews and Samaritans that a Jew would never sit at a table with a Samaritan. A Jew would never eat off of a Samaritan plate or drink from a Samaritan cup. They absolutely despise one another. And so this Samaritan woman is stunned that a Jewish man, a rabbi no less, would first of all just deign to speak to her, and then secondly, that he would be willing to drink from her bucket. But Jesus doesn't participate in that kind of prejudice. He doesn't engage in that kind of us versus them hostility. And to make a long story short, this woman responds to Jesus with kindness, presumably, by giving him a drink. And then Jesus responds to her with kindness by offering her living water so that her soul will never thirst again. Amen. And then following this encounter, the woman goes back into the village and she tells the entire town, she says, "There's a man outside the town. You got to come see this guy. I think he might be the Messiah." And she tells them all about the things that he said and did and how remarkable he was. And something very incredible happens here. The town goes outside the city, and they have their own encounter with Jesus, and then they invite Jesus and his disciples to stay with them in their village for the next 2 days. Now, ordinarily, you read the story, and you might just read right past that, but you have to understand how remarkable that is, that these Jewish disciples of Jesus, first of all, this is something they've never done in their lives, actually spend the night in a Samaritan village. I mean, it's very rare for them to even be in Samaria. Ordinarily, the common Jew would kind of walk around Samaria, even though it was longer and more arduous and not very convenient. They would rather walk all the way around the region of Samaria than step foot on Samaritan soil. This is unclean. We don't belong here. And if you're going to stay in a Samaritan village, though, you're going to eat off some Samaritan plates. And you're going to drink from Samaritan cups. So Jesus is teaching, among other things, he's teaching how we must be kind to one another. And then there's a second story that John's hoping you remember and connect with what's happening here on the cross when Jesus cries out, "I'm thirsty," and they give him sour wine. And it's the story in John 2 when Jesus and his earliest followers and his mother are invited to a wedding in nearby Cana. And, you know, Jewish weddings lasted about a week. I mean, 7 days. Imagine that. Imagine going to a wedding that lasts 7 days. And somewhere in the middle of the event, John tells us on the third day, the wine runs out. Which we kind of see that as a trivial thing, but in an honor-shame culture like in the ancient Middle East, this would have been intensely shameful and embarrassing to this family. And Mary goes over to Jesus and says, "You know, they've run out of wine." And Jesus says, "What does that have to do with us? My time's not come yet." And she goes to the servants and says, "Just do whatever he tells you." And then Jesus looks over and he sees 6 large stone water pots that would have been used for Jewish purification rites. Each one of them probably held between 20 or 30 gallons. They were large. And he tells the servants, fill each one of them, fill them with water up to the brim. And they do. And then he says, now take these water pots to the master of the feast. And they do. And you guys know the story. By the time the master of the feast drinks from the water pots, the water is turned into wine. And he says, you know, most people, when they throw a big event like this, normally they give the best wine first. And then once everybody's pretty well inebriated, then they bring out the cheap stuff. But you guys have saved the best for last. And so these stories that John weaves into his gospel, and he hopes that you'll connect with what's happening here at the cross, they show us the kindness of God revealed in Christ. And the kindness of God is extravagant in its generosity, turning much water into much wine, and it's the very best, and it's extravagant in its embrace, expansive, so that it even includes Samaritans. But here at the cross, Jesus has shown no kindness. There's no woman at the well to offer him water. Instead, he's given the bitter wine, the sour wine of human cruelty. You know, one of the most lamentable things about human beings is our capacity to be creatively cruel to one another. Originally, that's what the cross was. It was a creation of cruelty. Somebody long ago, hundreds of years ago, put some real thought and imagination into it. How can we execute our enemies in the most excruciating way possible? In fact, that's where the very word excruciating comes from. It means out of the cross, from the cross. So the cross originally was a symbol of human cruelty. And yet Jesus, in saving the world from our addiction to cruelty, takes the symbol of the cross and he transforms it really into a symbol of kindness. You know, you think today about the Red Cross. These are people who show up in the midst of a tragedy to offer kindness. The ancient world was a cruel place. If you've ever read from ancient literature, I mean, most of you have read the Old Testament, I would imagine. You see the cruelty there. It's almost like stunning to find it in our Bibles. But the cross of Christ stands as an eternal condemnation of cruelty and an everlasting call for us to enter into kindness. I want you to see cruelty and kindness as two polar opposites on the same continuum. Over here you have the most extreme cruelty, and over on this extreme you have the most extreme kindness. So you have cruelty and kindness that lie up upon the same line of sin and righteousness by which we are going to be judged. Let's define these two words for a moment. What is cruelty? Cruelty is callous indifference to the sufferings of others, and in fact, it might even take pleasure in the pain and sufferings of others. That's what cruelty is. Callous indifference to the sufferings of others, or even taking pleasure in the suffering of others. But there's something very important about cruelty I want you to understand. Most of the time, when people have become practitioners of cruelty, they don't identify themselves as cruel people when they're engaging in cruelty. Rather, they see it in pragmatic terms. We're just doing what needs to be done. Or they see it through the lens of justice. This person's getting what they deserve. You think of, for example, Pontius Pilate, or Caiaphas the high priest, or the soldiers who participated in the crucifixion. I don't think that these men saw themselves as cruel men. I think they saw themselves as men who believed in justice, men who believed in law and order. I think it's important that we keep that in mind. Kindness, on the other hand, is the impulse that leads us to act in a way to ease the pain and suffering of others. Here you see someone who's going through intense pain and suffering, and you're moved to act on their behalf, whether in a slight way or a significant way, to ease their pain and suffering, even if it's just the pain of embarrassment. This is what Jesus does when he turns water into wine. It wasn't just a neat little parlor trick or something like that. He turns water into wine in order to save this family from incredible shame and embarrassment. Here are a few thoughts on cruelty and kindness. A couple quotes here. G.K. Chesterton, he said, "Cruelty is perhaps the worst kind of sin." That's an interesting statement. Cruelty is perhaps the worst kind of sin. And you think about it and you're like, okay, is this hyperbole? Is he exaggerating? Is he kind of overstating that here? I don't know. It's G.K. Chesterton. Pretty well-respected guy. He tends to be the guy who regularly hits the nail on the head. And I think he's on to something there. I think cruelty is perhaps the worst kind of sin because it's related to dehumanizing human beings. What is a human being? Is it just someone who's intelligent and walks on their hind legs? No, a human being is one who bears the image of God. And when we engage in cruelty, we are defacing the image of God upon another human being. We are acting in a dehumanizing way towards others, and what we don't realize is that in the process, we are dehumanizing ourselves. We're defacing the image of God upon our own soul, which is great sin. Here's another quote by Abraham Joshua Heschel, a great 20th century rabbi and Jewish theologian. He says, "When I was young, I admired intelligent people. Now that I am old, I admire kind people." And perhaps there's a reason for that. I think it may have something to do with the fact that between Abraham Joshua Heschel's youth and his old age was this event called the Holocaust. You know, the Nazis could be very intelligent, even brilliant, but never kind. And Abraham Joshua Heschel was born in Berlin during the rise of all of that, and he was able to actually escape the Holocaust into America, but he was a witness to what happened. And as he's at the very end of his life, he's looking back and he says, "You know what, when I was younger, I used to really admire intelligent people, but now what I really admire about people is kindness." Finally, one more thought. This one comes from Philo of Alexandria. He was also a famous Jewish theologian only 20 centuries earlier, and he was a contemporary with Jesus, but he famously wrote this. He said, "Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle." Amen. When Christ says, "I thirst," he is identifying with broken humanity. This is a radical act of solidarity to the extent that Jesus is personally present in the thirst of all who suffer human need. Tell me if this statement rings a bell, if you've ever heard this before. "I was thirsty and you gave me a drink." Who said that? Jesus. In his parable of the sheep and the goats, Matthew 25, you remember? Jesus says, "When the Son of Man comes, he's going to gather the nations, he's going to judge the nations. And like a shepherd, he's going to separate the nations into two groups. Over here to his right are the sheep." Not to be confused with you guys on this side. Don't worry, goats over here. All right. But he's got the sheep over to his right. He's got the goats over to his left. He's going to separate the nations in these two groups. He's going to judge humanity. And the basis for this judgment, the criteria for this judgment, has to do with cruelty and kindness. And he's going to say to the sheep on his right, he's going to say, "Enter into the kingdom I prepared for you from the foundations of the world." And he says things like this, "For I was thirsty and you gave me a drink." And the sheep, who are the righteous, who are going to enter into the kingdom, they say, "When did that happen? You said, 'When I was thirsty, you gave me a drink.' When did we do that?" And he says, "I'm telling you, whatever you've done to the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you've done unto me." It's a radical act of solidarity. Notice he doesn't say, for they were thirsty and you gave them something to drink. He says, for I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. And he says to the goats the opposite. For I was thirsty and you did not give me a drink. Now here's a question that gets raised often. Some will say, well, who are these least of these? When Jesus says, whatever you've done unto the least of these brothers, who are the least of these? And I'm telling you, I've seen some atrocious answers to that question. I've seen some commentaries that are just terrible, where they basically say, well, you know, the least of, he's just talking about other Christians, which is a really nice, convenient way to perpetuate us versus them. Let's show kindness to one of our own, but if they're not one of our own, let's be callously indifferent. When in the parable itself, Jesus makes it crystal clear who the least of these are: the poor, the sick, the imprisoned, the immigrant. Now that last one right there is kind of a hot button topic right now, isn't it? A lot of discussion about what's happening at the border right now. And listen, I'm not here to sort that out. I understand the complexity of all of that. We all have opinions. There's 1,000 different things that we could come up with that should be done. What I will just say is this pastorally, is whatever we think about people right now who are at the border, we do need to understand that Jesus personally identifies with those kinds of people. Like, if you want to find Jesus right now, that's where you can find him. You can find him at the border. Let me tell you a story, and I'm going to close. Most of you know I came from Louisiana before I moved out here. I was pastor at a church for 8 years. And three years into it, we started a brand new ministry at our church for men with addictions, men with life-controlling issues. And it was a residential, it was a 12-month residential program, kind of like a teen challenge, if you're familiar. And we would take men in who had gone through some rough times. Most of them were addicted to substances of some sort. And we'd take them in at virtually no cost. And we'd house them for a year. We'd feed them for a year. We'd disciple them. And then we'd give them vocational training so that by the time they were ready to graduate after 12 months, they had secured a job and a place to live. So we weren't just getting them off of drugs. We were discipling them and also equipping them to reenter into society as a productive citizen. It's a beautiful ministry, beautiful. And one of my habits as a pastor, one of the things I got into doing is I made a point every week I would take one of those men out to lunch just to get to know them. No agenda, just I'd take them to lunch, spend about an hour or so with them, learn about their stories every week. And I'll tell you what was interesting for me. I started seeing a pattern without exception, with every single one of these men. That every one of these men that I heard their story, they all had, their stories had two things in common. Number one, every one of them was in a place of brokenness. But every single one of these men, this is what stunned me, every one of them had a deep wound from their childhood related to a parent in some way. Whether a mom or dad, they either experienced intense abuse or neglect, or there was a divorce, or there was a parent who they loved who passed away in their early childhood. Every one of them I can't think of an exception. And when I hear about these stories and when I put all of that together, it starts to help me to see these men as men who bear the image of God. And it humanized them. To hear their story, it generated compassion and mercy towards them. Did you know that when we started that program, there were people in our church who radically opposed it, who very vocally opposed it? Before we ever brought a man into the program, they already decided, what are y'all doing? You're welcoming, you're inviting criminals into our church, drug addicts, convicts, to sit and share the pew with me and my kids and my grandkids. These are criminals. And some of them left the church. But you know what? Every one of them that left, the families of these men took their place. And then some. And from what I understand, something similar happened here at Village when Wade started his recovery class all those years ago. A similar story. These people are bottom feeders. We have to decide at some point if we're going to join Jesus in what he's doing. Are we going to hear the cries of the hungry and the thirsty? And when we do, what will it be? Will it be the water of kindness or the vinegar of cruelty? All around us, I mean, goodness gracious, just step outside the door and look around. All around us are people who live in the margins, people who exist in the shadows. They're exiles from society. Some of it may be self-imposed. Some of us are victims of our own choices, obviously, but we've all been sinned against. We've all been wounded. And I think ultimately even our own choices are operating out of our own woundedness. That doesn't absolve us of our responsibility, but it helps us to see one another in a merciful, compassionate light. And we see people all around us who have been exiled, who are alone. And if you get around these people that are suffering, that are alienated, that are alone, these people that are estranged from society and they don't fit in, if you can hear them speak, you can hear Jesus talking. And if you have ears to hear and you'll listen closely, what you'll hear is, I thirst. And these people that are looking for just some simple act of kindness, of human affirmation, or human acceptance, what you're actually hearing is Jesus cry from the cross, I thirst. I was thirsty and you gave me a drink. Now I want to read from the very conclusion of the Bible. At the very end of the Bible, we read these words. In Revelation 22, verse 17, the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let everyone who hears say, come. And let everyone who is thirsty come. Let anyone who wishes take the water of life as a gift. The Spirit and the bride say, come. And may every member of Village Church say, come. And let all who are thirsty come. So that they can partake of the water of life and never be thirsty again. And as it says, it's a gift. You don't have to become deserving of it. You just need to come and take a drink.
Thank you for listening to today's message. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org.